It's Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, health insurers across the country, including here in Wisconsin, are suing the federal government over what they say are delayed reimbursements that were promised by the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
First, Scott Pruitt, the embattled head of the Environmental Protection Agency, stepped down from his position yesterday after numerous scandals came to light during his tenure.
These allegations ranged from renting a room in Washington, D.C. from an environmental lobbyist and paying about $50 a night to sending staffers to run personal errands for him and seeking high-paid positions for his wife.
In the interim, the EPA will be led by Deputy Administrator and former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler.
Our next guest is here to talk about the impact Pruitt had on the EPA and its future under Wheeler.
Nick Giuliano is the Deputy Energy Editor for Politico Pro. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Chris.
So Scott Pruitt has faced a lot of scrutiny since he started with the EPA, and up until yesterday, it kind of seemed like he could withstand just about anything. What finally did him in?
You know, I think that's been the sort of question that's been on everybody's mind for about the last 24 hours or so since this news broke. You know, President Trump said yesterday on Air Force One that there was, you know, quote, no final straw that led to this. You know, we've heard from folks within the White House that, you know, it was just sort of a gradual growing of, you know, day after day after day of scandal after scandal after scandal. Some of these just, you know, frankly, bizarre and embarrassing. And I think just the accumulation of that just finally became too much. And here we are, holiday week. On Monday, the Supreme Court nomination's coming down. Everybody's going to forget about it by then. So, you know, the timing was pretty convenient as well, it seems.
And this has been labeled a resignation, but was this really a resignation? What are you hearing?
John Kelly, who is a apparently on the way out the door himself, had been very frustrated with Pruitt for quite some time. We reported yesterday that, John Kelly was increasingly eager to see Pruitt out the door before he went out the door himself. So I think he was a big driving force on this decision, certainly.
And I understand that Pruitt submitted a resignation letter. What were some of the reasons that he included for his resignation?
Sure, yeah. I mean, he basically just said that, you know, he was very praised the president extensively in this letter, as he has done in numerous public appearances, but said, you know, I don't want to be a distraction from your administration. Just the accumulation of these negative stories has become too much. He portrayed himself as under attack by the media. I think that's a characterization that one can have some difference of opinion on whether or not that was actually the case.
And certainly the media has focused in on some of the more almost outlandish actions that we've heard about, reports that Pruitt was trying to get a used mattress from a Trump hotel, things like that. But putting aside the scandals and the reports and everything like that, what was he actually doing with his time with the EPA, and what were some of the actions that he put forward?
Sure, yeah. I mean, he was very, a key key member of the Trump administration, you know, implementing this very aggressive deregulatory policy. So he was, you know, in the process of pulling back President Obama, the rules that President Obama tried to put in place on, power plants contributions to climate change, on, you know, expanding the level of protections that, streams and wetlands get under the Clean Water Act, trying to limit other types of pollution that come, you know, that come out of mostly coal-fired power plants. Scott Pruitt had been in the process sort of throughout the last year of unwinding those at sort of various levels of success, but he was the pace had slowed down for some of those. He got some early setbacks and sort of, you know, had to be told by courts to, you know, really go through the proper procedure, you know, take all the necessary steps before you take these rules off the books. But he was in the process of doing that, and now his successor, Andrew Wheeler, will continue that work. Without hardly missing a beat, it doesn't seem like.
We are talking with Nick Giuliano. He is the Deputy Energy Editor for Politico Pro, and we're talking about the resignation of Scott Pruitt from the EPA. And you mentioned Andrew Wheeler. This is going to be, he was the Deputy Administrator of the EPA. He's now going to be stepping into that role on an acting basis. We know that he's got some ties to the coal industry, but tell us more about what we know about Andrew Wheeler.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Andrew Wheeler is a very well-known quantity in Washington. He was a lobbyist for Murray Energy was one of his clients. Several other energy companies were his clients. He also worked for, you know, biofuels trade associations. I think he had might have even had some clients in the agriculture industry. So he's had a sort of large portfolio of clients he had as a lobbyist. Before that, he spent quite a bit of time on Capitol Hill. He worked for the Environment and Public Works Committee and under Senator Jim Inhofe, who is still around. Senator Inhofe is from Oklahoma, like Scott Pruitt was. A lot of former Inhofe people had gone over to EPA, even with Pruitt. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the pieces are in place for a fairly high level of continuity as this transition takes place over the next couple of days.
And some Republicans are even saying that because of Wheeler's years working in both the federal government and the private sector means that he could be even more effective at making change than his predecessor. Do you think that's a pretty fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, like I say, he's been in D.C. for years. He sort of knows, you know, he knows how this town operates. He knows what levers to pull. He knows how to work a regulatory process in a way that, you know, Scott Pruitt, coming from Oklahoma, he was the attorney general there. He was, you know, a state legislator and a lawyer before that. He had not really, didn't really come with that deep well of expertise in how the federal regulatory process works. But Andrew Wheeler certainly has all of that expertise in spades.
And I'm also wondering about Democrats here. For a long time, it seems like national Democrats were pointing to Scott Pruitt and saying, okay, look, here's example A of a corrupt administration. You can point to all of these things. Are the Democrats kind of losing something, maybe a valuable tool here when it comes to riling up their base?
Yeah, they certainly are losing him as a very easy focal point to get people riled up and excited. I mean, it's going to be it's tougher to get get as much attention to some of the more wonky regulatory issues, which is where the story is going to go, compared to, you know, used mattresses from the Trump Hotel or Ritz-Carlton Hotel lotion or, you know, lights and sirens to get to the fancy French restaurant downtown. All of the sort of greatest hits of Pruitt's tenure. So yeah, I mean, the environmental movement certainly is going to be struggling to try and sort of keep that level of enthusiasm high. You know, I think Democrats would probably say that they will be able to find other targets within the Trump administration to, you know, go after on this corruption issue that has been a fairly rich one over the last year and a half.
I also want to ask you about a story that ran in Politico today about the EPA and a study about formaldehyde. This is probably something that Wheeler is going to have to deal with here as he takes over. Talk to me about what happened there.
Sure, yeah. So this has been, one of the, like I said, sort of the things that are happening behind the scenes that it's a little bit tougher to get attention to. EPA has been in the process of, sort of evaluating this health assessment internally that's part of a sort of scientific program that they have. This is a program that the chemical industry has been fairly critical of for years. The chemical industry has a lot of supporters now at EPA. A lot of former industry officials are over at EPA. A lot of former Republican staffers who have been sort of sympathetic to their arguments are now over at EPA, where they're sort of running the show. And so that level of influence that the industry has is coming to bear on things like this. We reported a few months ago that there was another similar study at HHS about chemicals and things like Teflon creating various health problems that had been buried for months and months. That actually finally came out, I think, you know, partially as a result of our reporting. And so now this formaldehyde study, hopefully it will still, you know, at some point see the light of day soon.
And what has the EPA response to this report been?
Sure. I mean, they say, you know, they're running the process internally. They just say they're going through the internal reviews that they have to go through, and they haven't really provided any sort of update on the timing for its release yet.
And do you have a sense as to, when we could see something? I mean, are we talking? I know we're talking about governmental stuff here, but I mean, could this be weeks? Could this be months? Or do we just not know at this point?
We sort of just don't know at this point. I mean, there was a hearing back at the beginning of this year where there was an exchange between Ed Markey, a senator from Massachusetts, and Scott Pruitt. You know, Markey basically asked Pruitt, "I understand this study is ready to go. What's happening?" Pruitt said, "You know, that's my understanding too. I'll see what happens and get back to you." EPA sent Senator Markey a letter yesterday saying, "We're still working on it. We don't have any update on timing." So it's just sort of wait and see at this point.
And as we enter our last minute here, I'm wondering what you're going to be watching for from the EPA and Andrew Wheeler going forward.
Yeah, I mean, the policy agenda, I think, will be fairly fairly consistent throughout. We're expecting a proposal to pull back to essentially redo the Clean Power Plan in a much more industry-friendly way. That could be going over to the White House as soon as today for a sort of interagency review process, and then, you know, beyond that, it'll probably be another maybe month or so until that becomes public. The Waters of the U.S. rule that continues to sort of move through the process. We should be seeing some more details on that maybe sometime this summer or fall. You know, those are the two big marquee things. And then beyond that, there are just, you know, the regulatory process continues apace.
And is Wheeler going to be pretty closely watched as someone to possibly take over this position on a permanent basis?
I think he will be. It's a little early to start sort of handicapping who the front runners are. I think he's certainly going to be part of that conversation. But, you know, beyond that, it seems like the White House probably is going to want to get past the Supreme Court nomination that's coming out on Monday, probably maybe even want to get past that entire confirmation process before they, you know, whoever they nominate, it's going to be a very tough fight on Capitol Hill that they're going to have to get this person confirmed. Under the terms of the law, Andrew Wheeler can stay there for about 6 or 7 months, so that gives them a little bit of breathing room to sort of get all their ducks in a row and, you know, maybe even see what the Senate looks like after the election in terms of who might be able to eventually get confirmed.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Chris.
Nick Giuliano is the deputy energy editor for Politico Pro. He joined us to talk about the resignation of EPA head Scott Pruitt and his replacement, Andrew Wheeler. Hundreds of health insurers have joined a lawsuit against the federal government over reduced and delayed reimbursements from the Affordable Care Act.
Wisconsin-based Common Ground Healthcare is the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit which seeks billions of dollars in back pay from the government. And it's the latest in a series of lawsuits brought against the government and the ACA since it became law 8 years ago.
Our next guest is here to break down this lawsuit, how it fits into the scope of legal challenges against the ACA, and the potential long-term impact the suit could have on the healthcare industry and the law.
Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of healthcare for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Guy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So first, since the Affordable Care Act became law, it certainly ended up in the courts a lot. About how many lawsuits and what type have challenged it in the past?
There have been numerous legal challenges. This has now gone on for 8 years. And as you know, two of these challenges made their way to the Supreme Court. And there are now at least two lawsuits, you know, one dealing with the insurers and another dealing with states, including Wisconsin, that have sued in Texas to overturn the law that could very well make their way to the Supreme Court.
So Wisconsin is playing a role in both of these current lawsuits, the one being brought by insurers. How does that fit into the scope of the other types of lawsuits that have been brought against the ACA?
Numerous lawsuits have been filed by insurers. What we wrote about this week, you know, focused on really just one of the claims or one of the lawsuits by insurers. We did the story in part because Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative is based here in Wisconsin. They are the lead plaintiff in one of the lawsuits. But again, numerous insurers have filed similar lawsuits contending or alleging that the government reneged on promises that they made when they entered the market in 2014.
Well, and let's dig into this lawsuit in particular, because they are saying that they were promised certain payments under the ACA that they have not received. What were they supposed to receive this money from the federal government for doing?
What this lawsuit and similar lawsuits that have been filed by other insurers contend is when the law was passed in 2010, it included three provisions to help insurers through the rocky first years of the Affordable Care Act, of setting up these marketplaces that were going to completely remake how insurance was sold to individuals and families who do not get health benefits through an employer or through a government program such as Medicare. Now, this is a market that is a very small piece of the overall market. That's often forgotten. That's often overlooked. Most people, more than 150,000 people, get insurance through an employer. But it was also a market that was widely criticized. A lot of health policy folks, a lot of economists contended that it was essentially a dysfunctional market. What the ACA did, or the Affordable Care Act did, is it would bar insurers from not selling insurance to people with pre-existing health conditions, or putting a rider on the policy where, for instance, you had an eye injury or a bad eye, and they would say, okay, well, we'll insure you, but we're not going to cover anything with your eyes. Or they would charge people with pre-existing health conditions much more. It also had a number of other requirements that were imposed on insurers, such as not allowing insurers to charge women more than men. So this was all going to be essentially a new market for insurers.
Right, they and in really reading your piece, Guy, you talked about how because this was a new type of insurance that they were offering, that they are different qualifications or lack of qualifications on the insurance, they really didn't know how much to charge because this was all new for them.
Exactly. It was guesswork in the early years. So there were these three provisions in the law, two of them temporary, one of them permanent, to help insurers get through those initial years until they had some claims data and would have a better sense of how to price their product. This nothing radical in this. When Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, was introduced, there was a similar provision, just because, again, people really would not know how to price their product. One of these provisions was called the so-called Risk Corridor Program, and insurers began selling policies in January 1st of 2014. Mm-hmm. In December of 2014, Congress put in this rider that said that this program had to be budget neutral, that the federal government couldn't use other funds, such as funds from the Medicare trust funds or the Medicare program, to offset any of these losses that insurers incurred. And that, you know, after they folks have been selling policies for, you know, 11, 12 months, they changed the rules.
Well, and also,
that's what these folks allege.
It also sounded like in your article, Guy, that there was supposed to be some offsetting from the beginning, I believe, where if insurers were losing money because they weren't able to price it accurately, the federal government would give these kickbacks. But then also, if insurers were actually making more money than was expected, they were supposed to kind of pay back a little bit. Is that right?
Yes, you're right. And that's a good point, although it turned out not to be a problem.
Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of healthcare for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about a lawsuit that involves Wisconsin insurers and others that says that the federal government owes them billions of dollars under the Affordable Care Act. And so these companies are suing for billions of dollars. It's billions with a B. Let's break down a little where those costs are coming from. What is costing the industry so much money that they expected to get reimbursed from the federal government and are not?
Well, the money in the first year, in subsequent years, they priced, they did not count on this money. And that was one of the reasons that premiums have gone up. And this is just one of the reasons why the individual market is essentially a mess, particularly for people who do not receive federal subsidies. Folks who receive federal subsidies have been protected because the subsidies cap how much they have to pay for insurance to a percent of their income. In some ways, the market has been turned on its head. Before the ACA, a small segment of middle-class folks could afford to buy individual insurance, you know, such as people who are self-employed. People with lower incomes, people in low-wage jobs that didn't provide health benefits could not afford it. Now, those folks can have access to insurance. It's the middle-class folks who have been hurt. And there have been numerous factors that have come into play here. This is really just one of them. And the real effect was just, you know, after 2014, because, again, insurers in subsequent years, you know, when they were pricing their product, didn't count on that money. And so they put a higher price on the insurance they were selling.
As we wrap up, Guy, it sounds like there is a trickle-down effect for other people who have health insurance, but not necessarily the people who whose coverage has cost these particular insurers money. What are you going to be watching for as this moves forward for what it means for the cost of health care?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, this is just one of many things that have gone into this market not working out as projected. Some of the problems in the market stem from the law's original design. The Obama administration also made a decision regarding so-called transitional plans. This was after the controversy regarding whether you could keep your own plan or not. All these things in their entirety have affected the market. And again, you know, some of these could be fixed. But of course, as you know, this is such a politicized issue that folks are not really interested in sitting down and saying, okay, how do we fix the mistakes we made? How do we make this work better? But we hope to do a story or plan to do a story this fall that will list all the different decisions that were made that got us to this point. And again, some of them stem from the plan's original design. I mean, the people who signed up for insurances, we've reported in numerous stories, you know, overall turned out to be sicker and have higher health care costs than expected, and not enough young, healthy people, in part because some of the original flaws in the law's design, have signed up for insurance. And that what you need is a big risk pool that has a mix of healthy and unhealthy people. Ideally, you want a heck of a lot more healthy people than unhealthy ones.
Well, Guy, thank you so much for explaining this lawsuit, and we'll certainly watch how this and the others progress.
Thank you.
Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of healthcare for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about a lawsuit filed against the federal government over reduced and delayed reimbursements from the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Marquette professor who was suspended after a controversial blog post. We'll find out about the case during our roundup of state news.
First, a 2013 study showed that Americans eat about 50 billion burgers each year, or about three a week for every person in the United States. Here's another burger stat. McDonald's says it sells 75 burgers every second of every minute of every hour of every day.
Maybe we all have our own personal spins on how we prepare our burgers. Producer Bill Martins likes his well done with cheddar, bacon, ketchup, mustard, pickles, and onions on an untoasted bun. Doesn't have quite the same ring as the McDonald's jingle, but you get the points.
Whatever your tastes, on this edition of Food Friday, our guest has some tips for getting the most bang for our burgers. We'll also talk dessert with ice cream and pies and a riff on lemonade.
Anna Thomas Bates is a writer and cheesemaker from the Greene County Village of Albany. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she recently wrote a four-part series about these summer classics. Her website is tallgrasskitchen.com. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, tell us a little bit about the series that you've been writing for the Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, you know, summertime is just all about relaxing, fireflies, swimming, and it's all about the food. We're going to barbecues, we're going to potlucks, we're going to parties, but no one wants to spend a lot of time cooking it, but you want to spend a lot of time enjoying it. So the series was all about some of these summer classics, pies, burgers, lemonade, ice cream, and how to have some interesting riffs on them and how to make them quickly and deliciously.
So, Anna, were burgers part of your 4th of July menu?
They were, yes. And we that three-week statistic was kind of surprising. I guess maybe
Chris
not.
And
I
thought so, too.
Burgers a week, but I do like them every once in a while.
Well, I want to tell you about the way I make burgers. So I get really good grass-fed beef, ground beef, and in the middle of them, I make kind of a little indentation, and I put in chopped shallots and also whole cumin seeds, and then a little salt and pepper, and then I fold it over. And basically, when the burger's on the grill, it kind of steams the shallots and the cumin, and so it's just it's very simple, and you know, not a lot of competing flavors, but it's got a really nice savory element to it.
Yeah, it sounds very fragrant and delicious.
It is.
So I'm on the opposite end of that. I take a piece of meat, and I throw it on the grill, so I'm a little uninspired. But how much room for creativity do we have, Anna, when it comes to making burgers?
Well, you know, the purists will tell you to put almost nothing into the meat, that if you really want to cook the meat the best way possible, first of all, they'll say to grind your own, which I never have time to do that, but it's, if you have the time, you should definitely go for it. The best tip I can give you is make sure you have some fat in that beef, and like Judith, I love to do pasture-grazed beef as well, but something with at least 20% fat is going to be ideal for on that grill. I do like to add in some herbs and some seasonings for flavor, but the purists will say just, you know, don't handle that meat too much. Get really good meat and just cook it gently to medium rare or medium, or if you're Bill, medium well or well done.
It's funny that you said that about meat grinding. I was at a store recently looking at some KitchenAid accessories, and there was a representative from KitchenAid there, and she was, you know, telling me about the benefits of the different attachments for the mixer, and she said, "Are you interested in grinding your own meat?" And I said, "I don't think so, but maybe I should be rethinking this. It sounds like this is a really great way to spice up your burger."
To really get the best texture, that's what the experts will tell you, is to grind your own. And a lot of it's just for, you know, where it's coming from. It's coming from one single piece of meat, and it's also not being handled very much, so you're going to get the best texture in that burger.
So, Anna, were we to get inspired and Chris goes out and buys that KitchenAid accessory, what kind of meat would you want to get to grind?
You know, basic chuck is just fine. As long as you have that fat content in there, that's kind of the most important element. You can get fancy and get sirloin, but really chuck is gonna taste delicious.
So what are some common mistakes that people make when they are actually grilling or cooking their burgers?
I think handling the meat too much, because it just gets dense, it seizes up, and then you're going to have a tougher burger. So you can put some seasonings and some herbs in it, but just be very gentle. Judith mentioned putting a dimple in the middle. She did that for her ingredients, but also when you're grilling, if you have a little indentation in the middle, that will also keep the burger from shrinking up too much, because that's just the way it cooks. Getting good meat and not handling it too much are kind of the best tips.
And I will say, I have heard right here on the Ideas Network on grilling programs that one of the worst things you can do is to press that burger down, because you're basically wringing out all of that good juice.
That is very true.
And does it make a big difference if we're cooking it on the grill, if we're cooking it on the stovetop, or somewhere else? Do you have a preferred way of doing it?
You know, the grill is nice in the summertime because you're getting out of the kitchen. It's not too hot. You're going to add some extra flavor, especially if you're using charcoal. However, if you are inside the house, using a cast iron skillet is another great way, because you can get it really hot like a grill and get a nice quick sear on the outside.
Well, Anna, you have a recipe for gremolata burgers, which we've posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And also, you can get that and many recipes from many different Food Fridays at WPR.org/Food Friday. First off, tell us what gremolata is.
Yeah, gremolata is just an Italian kind of herb, garlic, lemon zest mix. So it's very bright, very fresh, and a really great seasoning for summer. And typically, you can use it to top soup, to put on pasta. It's great on fresh bread, and here we mixed it into a burger.
So walk us through this recipe. How do we make this?
Yeah, so you're going to start by making the gremolata. So you're going to mince up a lot of parsley, some garlic, some lemon zest, and then you're just going to gently combine that with your ground beef and very carefully shape those burgers.
And are there any sides that go well with that? It's funny, I don't think of lemon with beef that often. Are there good side dishes that would go with that?
Oh, you know, you could do some very simple just grilled vegetables if you had some asparagus to throw on the grill with it, or a nice bright fruit salad would be delicious as well.
And I've got to ask you, Anna, what kind of bun do you prefer? Are you a traditionalist, you know, straight up white bun, wheat bun, or I'm a fan of pretzel buns. Do you have a favorites?
Those pretzel buns are really good.
Yeah.
And that's actually what I used for this one, because my kids love them too.
And go ahead, Anna.
I was going to say, sometimes I even skip the bun and just wrap it in lettuce with some tomato, some fresh, juicy tomato.
And, you know, we have to ask for Bill, toasted or untoasted?
You know, I maybe it's because I'm lazy, but I usually do not toasted.
All right. Well, Bill will be happy to hear that. We're talking with Anna Thomas Bates right now. She's a writer and cheesemaker from southern Wisconsin, and her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about a recent series she did on twists on all-time summer classics. Well, you know, we need to wash all these great burgers down with something. Lemonade is always popular on a hot summer day, but if we want to try a little something different, maybe a little less sugary, you have a beverage that involves hibiscus tea and lime juice. Tell us about that hibiscus lime Arnold Palmer. And Arnold Palmer is lemonade and iced tea, right?
It is lemonade and iced tea, and we are, in our family, a huge fan of Arnold Palmer's, primarily because then my kids are getting, you know, half the sugar of the lemonade because they're getting some nice tea in there with it. And so this is just a riff on that. So instead of using a black tea, I used a hibiscus tea, and Rishi out of Milwaukee has a really nice hibiscus tea. Also, Tazo, which is widely available in grocery stores, has a nice hibiscus tea called Passion. And instead of lemonade, we used basically a homemade limeade. So when you're making lemonade or limeade, equal parts simple syrup, which is sugar and water, equal parts sugar and water, and then add that to an equal part of your citrus juice, your lemon or your lime, and you've got a nice lemonade there, and you can add in your ice and water to the proper dilution. But yeah, mixing that up with a hibiscus tea, it's really light, really refreshing, and has a bright tropical twist.
And let's say we want to put a little extra something in the Arnold Palmer, any kind of spirits that would go nicely with that?
Oh, I would say gin, hands down.
We both just had that moment of contemplating this drink, and it sounded really good. What I'm also wondering, too, my only exposure, really, to Arnold Palmer's are those ones that come in those really big cans that are just super sugary, super sweet. I've never actually had a homemade one. What am I missing out on?
Well, that's the nice part of making your own, is that you can tailor it to how much sweetness you want. So you're freshly squeezing that lime juice or that lemon juice, so that's going to be very bright. And you can put in as much or as little sugar as you want. I think things are more refreshing when they're less sweet, especially in the summertime. And another thing, it's always kind of interesting to add a little tiny pinch of salt in some of these drinks. I don't think I called for it in this recipe, but especially for summertime, it can be really refreshing and can really cut that sweetness.
Wow, I never thought of that. Well, we're talking about classic summer food and new twists on them with Anna Thomas Bates. She's a writer and cheesemaker from Greene County. She recently wrote a four-part series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about burgers, lemonade, ice cream, and pies.
And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you like to cook and fix up your burgers? What kind of sides do you like to serve with them? What do you think is the secret to a great burger? And what's your go-to summer dessert or summer dish? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you go to wpr.org, we've posted Anna's recipes for gremolata burgers, fresh strawberry pie cups. We're going to get to that in a little bit. And many more. That's over on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well.
And we'll pick up this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
Right now, we're continuing our discussion about classic all-American summer fare during this Independence Day week. We're talking burgers, lemonade, pies, and even ice cream with Anna Thomas Bates. She's a writer and cheesemaker from Albany in Greene County. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and her website is tallgrasskitchen.com.
And we want to hear your twists on those and other foods that go along with summer at 800-642-1234. How do you like your burgers? Do you have a simple tip or recipe to share? And what sides do you like to serve with them? What's on the menu for your next summer cookout? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Anna, you've got a couple dessert options to share with us, both of which involve strawberries. Can't get much more summery than that. Let's start with a summer staple, the pie. Only this isn't the classic 9-inch round pies. These are individual cups. What's the story behind that?
So I run a little cheese shop in Paoli, and I have a regular customer, and he comes in once or twice every single week, and he usually comes in when it's slower, and we chat, and we were talking about the best fruit pie that we'd each ever had, and he mentioned a little place up in northern Wisconsin, and he said basically it wasn't a cooked pie, that it was a lovely, light, little individual pie crust, but then they just had macerated fruit put into the cup and served it with whipped cream. And I just thought how perfect that is, because when you cook the fruit, it just, it loses a little bit of its magic. But if you just macerate those berries, the strawberries, the raspberries, the blueberries, the little bit of sugar, let their natural juices come out, and then have a really beautiful, buttery, crisp pie crust, you have all the elements of a good pie, and it's actually so much simpler, too.
And for people who might not be familiar with the word macerate, can you tell us exactly what that means?
Sure. Basically, it's just adding a little bit of sugar, which brings out the liquid in those berries, so you're essentially creating a light, sweet syrup to go with those berries, but it's coming from the berries themselves. You're not adding anything except a little bit of that sugar.
And you're making that with just a traditional pie crust, and you're just kind of cutting it up into, you know, little smaller chunks, I guess?
Yeah, it's like a tart crust. You could use any pie crust recipe that is your favorite. I found one from David Leibovitz that was actually a French tart crust that had a really a different preparation, where you put the butter and some oil and water into the oven, let everything melt, added in that flour really quickly, and then it was very pliable and really easy to push into little muffin cups to make individual little pie cups. But you could do that with any favorite pie crust recipe that you had.
And so you're adding a little sugar to the berries. Is there anything else you can add in there? I mean, I've had strawberries with balsamic vinegar just drizzled on them, and that's an amazing flavor combination.
Yeah, strawberries are interesting, and they go well with some savory elements. Black pepper is another interesting thing to pair with strawberries.
And you can't have pie, I think, without ice cream. You certainly can't have summer without ice cream. Sticking with the strawberry theme here, you also have a recipe for strawberry shortcake ice cream. Now, I tend to think of strawberry shortcake as one thing. Ice cream is another thing. This sort of gives you the best of both worlds. Walk us through this recipe.
Sure. So I could do an entire show on ice cream. It is hands down my favorite thing to make all summer long. And so this was just a riff on one of my recipes. I took my favorite kind of vanilla ice cream base, which is from Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream. She runs a whole ice cream empire out of Ohio, and she has a great cookbook. And then I added essentially a strawberry jam ribbon in there. And then I just did crushed up shortbread cookies. But if you had your own shortbread cookie recipe, you could sprinkle that in as well. And then after the ice cream is made, you just fold in that strawberry jam and those shortbread cookies to get strawberry shortcake ice cream.
Wow, that sounds really delicious. Now, I have to admit that I'm kind of in the same category of never having thought of grinding my own meat for hamburgers. I've never actually felt like taking on making my own ice cream. It seems like a big process. What is the process of making ice cream at home?
So it can be very simple, or it can be more complex. I do have a small Cuisinart ice cream maker where you freeze the bowl and use that to stir and freeze the ice cream. You can get them, I think, for about $40, and they really make delicious ice cream. There are a lot of recipes online nowadays that use sweetened condensed milk, and because of the texture of that sweetened condensed milk, you can get away with making ice cream without a machine. But I think you get a little bit better results if you do have a machine or a KitchenAid attachment. So if you're going for that meat grinder, you might as well get their ice cream maker, too.
Maybe they'll have a deal on two attachments for the price of one.
And then once you start mixing up the ice cream, there's a few different ways to go, too. You can do custard, which would be a cooked egg and cream and sugar base, which is a little bit more complicated. In the recipe that I have posted, the strawberry shortcake ice cream, there's also a link to my super fast kind of family ice cream recipe, which actually you just mix up eggs, cream, half and half, milk, sugar, and vanilla, and you put that ice cream base right into your ice cream maker. But the best ice cream recipe that I found, hands down, is Jenny Brittenbauer from Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream. And she adds in a little bit of corn syrup and cornstarch and cream cheese. And all those elements work together to create a very thick, rich ice cream that doesn't get icy. That's kind of the biggest flaw with most ice cream recipes, is after about a day, they get very icy in the freezer. And this one tastes amazing for weeks, not that it would ever last that long in your freezer.
Yeah, I saw the cream cheese in the recipe, and I thought, I've never thought about putting that into ice cream before. Is that something that you can also use in other kinds of ice cream as well, do you think?
You could. I kind of use this recipe as a base for lots of different jumping-off points. I did a rhubarb crisp ice cream a year or two ago. There's only 3 tablespoons in there, so it's really just to add some concentrated fat to this recipe to get a very smooth texture.
We're talking with Anna Thomas-Bates right now. She's a writer and cheesemaker from southern Wisconsin. We're talking about some new twists on classic summer fare, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Anna, what about other desserts, maybe, or other types of ice cream? Are there some that are a little less sweet, might appeal to some of the more adult members of the group? We talked about what spirits we could put into our Arnold Palmer. Are there any boozy ice creams that we might want to consider?
There are. You can definitely add booze to lots of different ice creams. You can't add a whole lot because it messes up the freezing point of that ice cream. But I have definitely done, I've done a bourbon peach ice cream before that turned out really well. So vanilla, bourbon, and peaches are a nice complement to one another. But you can also do ice pops. So if you don't want to do the ice cream maker, you can also consider just getting some basic popsicle molds or using paper cups, and then you can add booze into those as well. There's lots of different options to go that way.
So Anna, you said that, you know, we could do a whole show on ice cream, and I think we could. I mean, what's happening in your kitchen all summer long? Are you constantly, you know, churning out new flavors, trying different experiments, and maybe what are some of the results of the more successful experiments?
Yeah, I really like to go with the seasonal flavors, and kind of the easiest way to take advantage of all of that produce that's happening is to basically do a little jam like I did with strawberries. So you make a great vanilla ice cream base, and then if you have peaches or blueberries or blackberries or raspberries, if you just either roast them a little bit, and a lot of this is just to remove some of that extra liquid, which would make your ice cream too icy. So you either roast them or you put them on the stovetop with just a tiny bit of sugar and cook them down a little bit. So like you're making a super fast jam base. And then once that ice cream is churned, you just fold that in like a nice ribbon of whatever lovely seasonal local fruit that you have.
Are there any simple sauces for putting on the ice cream? I mean, these ice creams sound like they would be amazing on their own, but sometimes it's nice to have just a little bit of garnish on there.
Yeah, I mean, you can again, use the fruit as a sauce. There's some really good simple hot fudge recipes or chocolate syrup recipes if you want to make that on your own as well. What's really Wisconsin and very simple, especially if it's vanilla or peaches, is just a little bit of maple syrup as a topping.
Hmm. So we've talked a lot about iconic summer dishes, certainly burgers, ice cream, pie, things like that. I also tend to think of hot dogs, bratwurst, various sausage, and that's just for me personally. But I'm wondering if are there any other like quintessential American dishes that are a must-make for you every summer?
You know, I think I kind of covered them in this series, the lemonade. I mean, I also love to do big, beautiful salads, and I like to add a little bit of fruit to those salads, too. So nectarines, peaches, blueberries with some really great spinach and some nice lemony dressings with lots of herbs are kind of another summer staple.
What about, we're going to be in the midst of corn season pretty soon. What about any interesting ways to use all that great Wisconsin sweet corn?
Well, you can actually do sweet corn ice cream, which is amazing. And there are some recipes on the JS Online for some good sweet corn ice cream. But grilling corn is another great way to go. And there's kind of some debate whether you should grill it in the husk or not in the husk. It's very simple to soak that husk in water for a few minutes, and then put that right on the grill, and that way the steam kind of cooks the corn. But I'm also kind of a advocate of the basic old-fashioned, you know, boil it in a pot for just like under a minute. It barely needs to be cooked when it's that fresh and sweet, and just some really great Wisconsin salted butter on top.
I've also had really good corn with kind of a compound butter, so some herbs or some spices right in the butter too.
Yeah, and then kind of the Mexican street grilled corn with some chili and some lime and some sour cream is really delicious too.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anna Thomas-Bates is a writer and cheesemaker from Greene County in southern Wisconsin. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about her favorite twists on classic summer meals.
And you can find recipes that she shared with us, including her gremolata burgers and that strawberry shortcake ice cream, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or at WPR.com/Food Friday. Many of us have fond memories of our favorite cereals growing up. They certainly weren't the healthiest things, but we begged for them anyway. And although sales of sugary cereals are down, it's not enough to prevent cereal makers from getting, well, extra creative.
Yeah, we learned this week about the existence of, you ready for this, Judith, Dippin' Dots cereal. Yep, that's right. The ice cream of the future is now also the cereal of the future, and it apparently comes in both banana split and cookies and cream flavors. I don't know, Judith, what do you think?
I just don't understand how it works.
I don't either, but you know, I sent this to the team the other day, and it got us going on like an hour-long Slack discussion about favorite cereal memories, favorite cereals. Did you have a favorite cereal growing up?
So growing up, I really didn't eat, I didn't like milk much when I was a kid, which is, I know, not very all-American, but I didn't eat much cereal as a kid, but in college, at dinner time, they still kept the cereals out, and I ate so much Captain Crunch that I think I have permanent scars on the roof of my mouth from ripping it apart, but it was so worth it.
I think everyone who had that cereal just like felt that pain in
yes.
their mouth right now. I ate a lot of Oreo O's, which had like the little marshmallow like chunks in there, and the cereal went away. They brought it back. It doesn't have the chunks anymore, so I don't think it's worth having.
Well, tell us about your favorite cereals growing up or today by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Coming up next, it's news, and then we'll find out why the state Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Marquette professor on a free speech issue. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.